Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Who controls your access to information on the Internet? With billions of pieces of content available instantly on an ever-growing variety of devices, it might seem we users are fully in charge of our online explorations. But as author and Columbia Law Professor Tim Wu reminds us, a lot of our access is filtered through a surprisingly small number of big companies like Facebook, Google, and Apple, which have evolved according to the same cycle that defines traditional telecom and broadcast companies. So that while a large number of small innovators experimented with internet business models and technology development in the beginning, a lot of our online access today flows through these mega companies, which have significant financial interest in squelching upstart competitors. Tim Wu explains in his new book, The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires. Tim, welcome to Think.
Thanks. It's a pleasure to be here.
So in this case, the master switch is really about gatekeeping power. Can you talk a little bit about why our access to information is not, in fact, as free as we imagine?
Sure. Well, the master switch comes from a quote from Fred Friendly, the famous media personality in the mid-century.
CBS News.
Yeah, at CBS News, and he did the famous reporting of McCarthy and so forth. And the idea is that, you know, on top of sort of the superficial debate about free speech that we have, that the question is who really owns the underlying pipes and the underlying infrastructure. What is the industry structure like? And that has a huge effect on speech in America. Today, I don't want to say that it's I think we're in a relatively free environment. I don't want to overestimate it. But most of us subscribe to either a cable company or a telephone company as a gatekeeper for Internet access. And when you think about, you know, when you get to stuff, it's almost always through Google, maybe sometimes through Facebook, some people Bing, but mostly Google. And so there are increasingly not that many companies who have some say in what we hear or see.
You write here about this cycle that's been repeated over and over since the advent of electronic communication. It begins with a sort of free-for-all dominated by small innovators. Over time, though, things begin to coalesce around fewer and fewer players. Can you describe that for us a little
sure.
bit in more detail?
My book is mainly a history book, and it is about exactly what you describe, this cycle. Typically, what you see is something new is invented, radio or the telephone, and there's this period at the beginning where nobody really knows what this is going to be. And there's these utopian or very open periods of intense competition, entrepreneurship, something like, in the 90s with the Internet, you saw everyone was starting a web page or doing some kind of with the computers in the 80s, similarly. Radio was like this in the 1920s and the 1910s, the 1900s. The phone network was something. In fact, in Texas, I did some research, and people, you know, there's a lot of firms that just started by wiring farmhouses together. So you have these periods, and almost inevitably, after about 10 or 20 years, there tends to be the rise of either a single great monopolist or something of a cartel of firms that, in some sense, seize control of the market. And that's a cycle that's repeated itself many times.
What's so interesting about that cycle is that very often when this large single company or confederation of companies come together, it's because of consumer demand.
Exactly. Typically, a new invention, at first a novelty is good enough. You know, the first radio programs like this one, just hearing someone's voice coming through a box is crazy. You know, you can just imagine being I don't think anyone's old enough to remember this. One man might be. Justice Stevens of the Supreme Court, who just retired. Justice Stevens told me once he could remember the first time radio came on in the 20s. And
wow.
It amazed him. He was a man who remembered meeting Babe Ruth, which had always impressed me. Anyway, you can imagine at the beginning, people are just, this thing is great. You think of our own experience with the Internet in the 90s. The first time I logged on to email or something, I thought, wow, what's going on here? But usually, as you just said, consumers, once they get kind of used to the thing, they want it to be more secure, a bit more reliable, maybe a little less spam or whatever spam is in the time. And so there's a lot of consumer demand creating monopoly, to be honest. I think we have to not so much point the finger at the companies, but also ask ourselves, you know, we've created Google because they have a great product. In AT&T, in the 19th, the greatest monopoly of them all, they offered a very reliable service and had good long-distance services. So in some sense, you're right. It is consumer demand that creates monopoly.
So let's go back to the 19th century. I thought this was really interesting. Western Union and the Associated Press formed a partnership.
Yeah.
And of course, they're not doing this today, but the Associated Press at the time had a sort of vested interest in who got elected president.
Yeah, they did, very much.
And talk about what happened there.
I mean, the Associated Press was very, so close to the Republican Party that they basically worked together. And this is a lesson in some of the dangers of unbridled, completely unregulated private power in the information industries. As you said, Associated Press had the only wire news service in the United States, so they were the only way to find out what was going on in an instantaneous way, because they had an exclusive deal with Western Union, the only telegraph company. And so if you want to know what's happening, it was an instantaneous basis. The only competitor was the Mail. It was these companies had it. And as you suggested, and as I was just saying, they just were very open that they were supported the Republican Party. And so they would run news, I mean, a little bit. Imagine, for example, like MSNBC or Fox. One of the two was the only possible cable news station, period. It would be a very different environment where you had a company like that. And they even went further. I don't want to go on too long, but one thing they would do is they were the only telegraph service, so they would basically take telegrams sent by the Democratic Party and hand them over to the Republican Party. So that's how they found out, oh, you know, we think we might lose this election. They're like, oh, we have to devote more resources to that area or something. You know, the privacy violations were astonishing. It's a real lesson of what, if you really let the stuff get completely unregulated and monopolized, there's some danger, not just to, like, you know, oh, there's nothing to watch on TV, but a danger to democracy itself.
And I guess, again, because there was no competitor, people not only didn't know what was going on, but had no other choice regardless.
Right. I mean, the only competitors in the time, there were Democratic newspapers, but they didn't have the advantage of wired news. That is to say, they didn't have the advantage of news that came immediately, and news that goes faster has a huge advantage. Yeah, it's an incredible situation, and I mean, there was a lot of things going on then. The South was under Reconstruction, so couldn't vote. But it is notable that there were Republican presidents, just one after another, for so long until Woodrow Wilson, because this party was partially because they had an incredible partnership with the only newswire organization.
So let's talk about the telephone industry, and I should say the segment that we now refer to as landlines, old-school
right.
telephones. AT&T did not initially, not only did it not meet any resistance from the government in taking over the industry, but it had encouragement.
That's right. The government, there was a little bit, they started a small antitrust investigation, but eventually the government came to the conclusion that, you know, let's face it, monopoly is better. And this is the line that that AT&T itself was pushing very strongly. We're talking about 1915 now. Is AT&T, they went to the public and said, listen, competition is a bad idea. It's wasteful. It's immoral a little bit. People undercut each other. What we need for this country is to let good men control giant industries and just let that be the way it is. And we sort of think of that sounds far-fetched now, but on the other hand, we have companies, and I love Google, but, you know, basically we said, okay, you've got a monopoly, just be good, and that's how we're going to do it. There is this recurring tendency in America to have many of our information markets run by a monopolist who then promises good behavior. And we're talking about the government. The government said, all right, we're going to actually help you by banning competition, but we're going to regulate you. So that started this history of private-public partnership.
And talk about how, I mean, I think people understand that it can hurt consumers in terms of price structures, but what are the other concerns about having, say, one big company, and we know, of course, that the bells were eventually broken up, but one big company controlling something as all-pervasive as telephone service?
Right. Eventually is an important term because it took 70 years. They had a nice run of 70 years, which, you know, you think about now a company being in a monopolist for 70 years seems kind of unbelievable. So usually there's a sort of predictable cycle. At the beginning, the company, when it takes charge, is usually pretty good. They have sort of this zest, and they usually have really great products. And, you know, for about 10 years or so, there's this golden age at the beginning of any information monopoly. The part that starts to hurt, where consumers start to feel it, is beyond that part. After a while, the company tends to get less interested in any more innovation and just sort of sticks with things. And one thing that happens is you might expect prices to eventually go down, and they don't. So you're stuck with much higher prices that never, ever go down. That's one problem. Another problem is that any inventions that might be interesting to consumers that threaten the monopolist often end up being suppressed. And I'll give an example. Bell, in the early 30s, invented the tape recorder. But they decided that it was dangerous to the future of the telephone. So, and I talk about this, and so they end up suppressing the tape recorder and the answering machine for decades. And the reason there's a lot of reasons, but one of them is that they believe that people use the telephone mainly for indecent matters. You know, they call people to talk about things that they consider indecent. So if there's a tape recorder, no one will use the telephone. So they squash the tape recorder. The point is, for consumers, you would miss out a lot on new things when you have a monopolist in charge for too long.
It's funny to think, too, it also sounds like such short-sighted thinking in terms of the reality that they could have made a decent amount of money if they'd sold telephone answering machines in the 30s.
Yeah, well, no, but they had this idea that it would... Exactly. There's a secret memo from AT&T, which I uncovered during this research. And they talk about it, and they sort of mention that, but generally they feel Americans will abandon the telephone if tape recorders exist. Not if, like, everyone has one, but even if they just exist. And they think they have the power to make it not exist. And, in fact, they do. They have this incredible laboratory, Bell Labs, and they just bury that research. You know, since I've written this book, I've been getting emails from people who used to work at Bell Labs. Uh-huh. And I got one great one from this gentleman who said, you know, I worked there, and we just buried we had this great hearing aid technology because we had, you know, we understood ears and telephones. Uh-huh. We had to bury that, too, for some unknown reason, and it took 10 years before the hearing aids came back
to
the level. So all these things happen, and it's a very dangerous... You know, research laboratories and universities basically aren't interested in trying to hide their results. But
yeah.
The problem with corporate laboratories, they have some incredible resources, but they often have this interest in kind of burying stuff. It's very dangerous.
So radio waves initially were open to just about anybody who could build a transmitter of some kind.
Right.
As that started to change, once again, the thinking was that limiting the number of smaller players meant better service for consumers.
Right. It was exactly the same logic. Is that it's a very popular logic in the 20s and 30s, and I think we still have some of these instincts today. Is that they looked at radio in the 20s, the FCC, and actually the radio industry, and said, you know, it's too chaotic, too many different voices. It was very amateur. It was kind of like what we're doing right here. Similar to public radio in the sense that, you know, here I am talking to the people. It's not quite amateur, but it's not highly produced.
Right.
right. You know,
we think of it as professional, but it's bare bones.
Yeah, I mean, there were like three or four people who are doing this, and our listeners. And no, but they wanted everything to be sort of bigger, one station for the whole country. This was the logic that led to the invention of NBC.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I have to add something else in here since we're talking about radio. Another major factor that forced the centralization of radio was the invention of advertising.
Yeah.
Now, originally the idea was, 1922, people said, radio is this incredible invention. We can't have advertising. And that there was the Secretary of Commerce, Herbert Hoover, gave a speech where he said, it is inconceivable to have radio chatter, advertising chatter, besmirch the dignity of radio. It's just unthinkable. You know, it was too amazing. It would be like putting up billboards in the Grand Canyon or something. It's just unthinkable. But eventually, advertising becomes a dominant revenue model. Thank goodness not for public radio. Public radio didn't exist yet. And that became the dominant advertising model. And that is a model where you want everyone listening to one thing because then they're hearing the ads. Well, I have all kinds of people like listening to church radio or to amateur radio or to like the motorcycle club. There's some motorcycle clubs at a radio station. That's too scattered. So anyway, that is why we saw the great centralization of radio.
Tim Wu is my guest. He's an author and professor of law at Columbia University. His new book is called The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires. Join the conversation by calling us at 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/PlanoCFP.
Plano CFP. You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Tim Wu. He's an author and professor of law at Columbia University. His new book is called The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Tim, is there some reason the communications industry is particularly susceptible to monopolization?
It's a great question, and I think there are a number of reasons. Probably describing all of them would take too long, but let me put out a few. One is the sense that these industries are almost always based on networks. You know, whether it's the networks, the radio networks, NBC, CBS, later became TV networks. Obviously, the telephone network, the Internet is itself a network by its very definition. And networks have unusual properties that whoever has the bigger network is usually more valuable than a smaller one. Some of the listeners use Facebook. Why do you use Facebook? Because it's the biggest one. There's more people on it. And so if you want to actually find your friends or so on, they're there. The old AT&T network in the 1910s, it beat out its weaker competitors, partially because you could just reach more people. It had better long-distance lines, actually had long-distance lines. So you picked up an AT&T telephone, it meant you could reach millions of people as opposed to 10 people or 1,000. So that has a huge effect on these industries and tends to drive them towards monopoly. It's not the only reason. I think there is something very tempting about being the champion or the head, a mogul of an information industry that seems to attract a certain personality that wants to, in some sense, own the media. This is the classic media mogul, not so much in the telephone, but definitely in film and in radio and these other empires. You can see there's this temptation to grab the master switch, as it were. And I think that has an effect. So, yes, there's the economics, human nature, and, again, our own consumer behavior have all conspired to tend to create monopolies in these sectors.
We haven't really talked about film very much here, but that's also a fascinating element to this story. In the early days of cinema, there were all kinds of people making movies.
Yeah, it's true. There were film industries all over the country. One of the things that you see is a geographic change. In early parts of these industries, they tend to be scattered all over the country. We talked about early radio at one point, and we talked about in Texas or in Dallas when there would be, now you do have SBC, but when there was tons of local telephone companies trying to hook up people. What tends to happen is a geographic consolidation. So the film industry, there was one in San Francisco, one in Chicago, a major film industry in New York, also, of course, in Hollywood, Los Angeles. And there's a 20-year period whereby the film industry, which was really quite scattered, became dominated by a few major studios with very different business models.
And, you know, these days, directors are still fighting to get independent pictures produced and funded. But there are people who will say sometimes indies are great, but often a very big budget movie delivers more for people.
Yeah, and in terms of what I think it's better when we have both. Mm-hmm. The problem was, if you look at a period from the 1930s through the early 70s, it was studios or nothing.
Yeah.
It was really just the only way film was made in this country was in a certain way. And one of the things, the real danger, if you're interested in the future of the Republic or its past, is the problem of censorship, private censorship. The problem with having the film industry so concentrated is it became much easier to censor. And I tell the story in the book of the Legion of Decency of a Catholic movement to censor the film, to write a code for film, the famous Hays Code, mm-hmm. which is pretty censorial. One example I talk about in the book is Warner Brothers had the idea in the mid-30s that they had, all these things were going on in Germany. They wanted to make a film to expose the Nazi Party and say, you know, these guys are trouble. And it got censored by the head of the Catholic Censorship Board. I don't mean anything against Catholics in general, but this particular gentleman, Joseph Breen, censored the film, so we didn't have this film made up about the Nazis in the 30s. And Breen was a terrible anti-Semite. You know, he didn't like Jews at all. And so you have this anti-Semite censoring films which could have been made. Anyway, I could go on about that. But the point underlying it is industry structure makes censorship much easier. If you have one film industry in one spot, it's very easy to censor. If you have a scattered industry, it's much more difficult.
And part of it, too, is that if you have sort of most favored status granted by the government to continue operating as a monopoly or a near monopoly, you want to keep government folks happy.
Of course. Of course. That's true, too. And there was some sense that if they didn't censor their industry, that they would be censored by government. Although I should point out, the worst censorship in this period was private. It was I won't overstate this, but it was interesting because it was the Catholic Church censoring mostly Jewish industry on behalf of a Protestant majority. that was the
what could go wrong?
In American film, and I don't know. It's fascinating to me. And this is where, you know, the way Hollywood movies sort of, I like big blockbusters, but you know how they sort of have the happy ending.
Yeah.
That was the rule for a long time. You had to have a happy ending. It was fascinating to look at the structure of the old censorship codes. Is it had to be a happy ending or, you know, you could have, for example, corruption. You could have an individual policeman be corrupt. You could never have the entire force be, you know, in the end he had to be punished because you had to show in the end that the system was right. You should never challenge established wisdom. And a film like, let's say, Godfather, which I don't think we think is a crazy film, was unmakeable for decades because it was glorifying criminality, you know, making the gangsters look like heroes. So you couldn't have a gangster be a hero for like 30 or 40 years. Anyway, so that's some of the stuff that happened.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. Tim Wu is with us. His new book is The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires. Let's go on the phones now to Ed in Arlington. Hey, Ed.
Hi, Chris. A comment was made a few minutes ago by our guest, Dr. Wu, who spoke of the early advent of commercial support of radio in this country. But it seems to me that radio was at least as influential in Germany, in France, in Britain, elsewhere in Western Europe around the same time. And I'm wondering if Dr. Wu could comment on how that model worked. Was radio commercially supported in those countries at that time? I know in England you've got the BBC, which was the dominant force, and I don't believe that was commercially supported. I'm not sure if there are any commercial radio stations in England. And somewhat related to this, I'm wondering if either of you all have ever seen a play called Voices of the Prairie, which I saw a little over 20 years ago. It was about the early days of radio in the U.S. And basically it laments the decline from the ideal that was supposed for radio, what radio was thought to be capable of becoming in this country versus what it's become, the commercialization of it, and what a letdown that is.
Sounds interesting. Tim, what do you know about all that?
Great questions, and they're both subject of, in the book, I have a chapter on the different approaches to radio that people took in the 1920s. It's hard to summarize all of it. I'll talk about England, first of all. England had the BBC, which was actually a private company. People think it's originally was a private company, given a government monopoly over radio. And they were supported not by advertising, but by a small tariff that was on radio sets. So every owner of a radio set paid for a license, and I don't know how much it cost. And that was used to fund programming, so no advertising. They were interesting, the BBC, because it was run by a man named Lord Reith, later was made a lord, and he believed he had been sent by God to make radio great. And his idea of radio was very straightforward. He said, we must make radio the best of everything. So all the best learned people speaking, the best possible music, so on and so forth. Just the best of everything. That is what radio should be. A very, very interesting vision. And sort of the origins, in some ways, of public radio. And you can see the influence of the early BBC on NPR today, kind of very straightforwardly. And on other radio places. Now, that's England. There's some good things to say about that. It didn't quite have the kind of experimentalism that American radio had. They were a little bit, for example, talking about politics, they thought was a crazy idea on English radio. Now, let me move over to the worst example of what happened to radio and of centralization. I mean, commercialism is maybe a bad thing, but in Germany it became the spiritual weapon of the totalitarian state. That is, radio was very quickly turned into a propaganda machine in countries like Germany and the Soviet Union. And it was terrible. What the Germans did is they invented prime. They had a different version of prime time, one which was mandatory. That is to say, you weren't allowed to miss it. You had to sit there. It was called the national hour and listen to political leaders tell you things for an hour every day. Hitler and so forth. And that is. And what's really interesting for me. I mean, everyone's sort of heard about that. But what's really interesting is what made that possible was a centralized underlying structure. That is, the industry structure really influences what the technology gets used for. And if early radio in America was sort of about free speech and liberation, a centralized, single-point controlled radio was, within 15 years of its invention, as Joseph Goebbels said, the spiritual weapon of the totalitarian state. So there's a lot at stake in these questions of media structure.
Was it enforceable to have everybody sit down for an hour every night and listen to what the government had to say?
I think it was, yes. I wasn't there or anything, but it seems to me that in the mid-30s Germany that life was rather carefully regulated. So these things would go off. It was like the national hour, and everyone, if you were in public, would have to go to a listening room. And I suppose if you were on the street, the policeman would push you into some kind of room to listen to the radio.
So the
different version of prime time, huh?
Yeah.
We kind of go for prime time. We sit down voluntarily every day, but this was, a different version of it.
And no time shifting available in Nazi Germany. People think of the internet in a totally different way, as something that would be impossible to make into a closed system. But is the definition too simple that by nature the internet is an open medium?
I don't think it's impossible. I don't think it's impossible, but as I do say in the book, there are certain things about the internet that make it possible that it will be different this time around.
Mm-hmm.
It was invented, and from the beginning was a public project, while the rest of them were mostly funded by started by private sources. So it began the internet with a sort of a decentralized, a libertarian spirit, even though it was funded by government, which sounds kind of backwards. You have a libertarian project funded by the government, but it always had this kind of a disorganized nature to it, and so it is a lot more resistant to control than some of the other media proved to be. One of the stories I tell in the book was of the effort of AOL Time Warner in the early 2000s to sort of try to turn the internet into something more that Time Warner was used to, and it failed. They were not able to control. The merger was a huge failure. They were not able to control internet consumers who use search engines to go around. So there are some pretty big differences. Even that being said, all things can be overcome. And as we saw in the 20s, American radio was a crazy, even all over the world, was a sort of open, crazy, the voice of God, people called it. And the next thing you know, it becomes Goebbels' tool of a control of the citizenry. So I think anything can be changed. Nothing is set in stone. So to say it's impossible that the internet be controlled is simply wrong.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phones to Gerardo in Allen. Hi, Gerardo.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Sure.
Hey, one of the comments I have is that I think this idea is not unique to information systems. I know one of the biggest myths in business is when a businessman says he wants an open and fair market. I've been involved in many meetings where they say that, but all their actions point in trying to secure a market for exclusive or monopolistic ways. So this idea that the business is more efficient when there's open markets, that's an idea, but a lot of people work in it the opposite direction. They want to make it easier for themselves to corner a market and then after that protect it.
Yeah, I think that's a good point. Can I just answer directly?
Yeah.
My only area of deep knowledge is the information industries, but I hesitate to speak on everything. But I do know in the 1910s that the leaders of AT&T, for example, were much more honest about their interests. They'd said, listen, monopoly is just better. Let's just face it, and we shouldn't have competition. Competition is bad for America. That was they just went out and said it. Today, business leaders, I think you're right. They would never say that. It's sort of like eugenics or something. It's not something you talk about in the public. But a lot when they're in their heart of hearts, most heads of very powerful businesses have no interest in competition. And why would they? Once you're in charge, why do you want someone else to take over? It's sort of like if congressmen could abolish elections, well, they might hesitate, but they might like it, too, because then you would never have to run for office again. Everything would be just fine.
They just wouldn't want to put their names on the bill that abolished elections. They would let someone else take charge.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, the politicians, this hasn't really happened in America, but in most countries, and someone will come to power, and at first everything's great, there are new reforms. And pretty soon they start to abolish elections. And, of course, it's just like businessmen are – people are the same. Business people, when they're in charge, they don't like competition anymore. When they're not in charge, they love it. And, people who are out of power like elections. People who are in power hate them. It's just like that.
Well, in reference to those who are in charge, you write about this phenomenon that happens over and over from industry to industry called the Kronos effect.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that?
Sure. Well, it's based on this a little graphic, but maybe hopefully not too graphic for the public airwaves. There was this the ruler of the universe in Greek mythology. The second ruler of the universe was Kronos, and it had been foretold that he would be displaced by one of his children. So, as they were born, he just ate them, swallowed them, and that was his method of dealing with the problem. And you see this with companies that. Once they're in charge and it's clear that they will be superseded by a new innovation, they tend to eat the innovations or co-opt them or try to control them or just destroy them. And you see this repeated over and over again. The good example is a telegram company, Western Union, when it heard of the telephone, it tried to take it over and turn it into sort of an adjunct to the telegram as opposed to its own product. AM radio put FM radio out of business for decades. Using federal regulation and law and other techniques, even though everyone knew FM was better, but AM radio they felt threatened by this technology, and so they snuffed it out. It didn't completely snuff it out, but basically it was dead by 1951, even though it was invented in 1934 or so, and didn't catch on until the 70s. So old technologists feel threatened by the new, so they always try to destroy it.
Tim Wu is my guest. He's an author and professor of law at Columbia University. His new book is called The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires. Join us by calling 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Continuing and Professional Education, announcing a 9-month intensive CFP certificate program starting in January in Plano. You can learn more at smu.edu/PlanoCFP.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Tim Wu. He is an author and professor of law at Columbia University. His new book is called The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or by sending email to think@kera.org. Tim, at the risk of carrying this metaphor too far, my son reminded me that in the story of Kronos, in fact, all those babies he swallowed survived in his belly, and eventually he got what was coming to him. Is there reason to believe that all these suppressed technologies and ideas and individuals will eventually have their day?
You know, it's a great point. I think the trick was that they had him swallow a stone instead of Zeus, and somehow Zeus got them to get out of their stomach. On the other hand, they're gods, so they can survive almost anything. There is a way in which sometimes they do come back. Now Kronos does fail. When you read the book, you'll see that sometimes Kronos wins, sometimes he fails. The strongest example of failure is the telegram, where they really, because of federal patent, actually, they fail to destroy Bell. Mm-hmm. And so Bell becomes what we now know as Bell AT&T. If that hadn't happened, by the way, we would never have had Bell, and we would have had some company. I think the name was the American Telephone System or something, ATS. So that would have been our world, by the way. And a telephone would have been a lot different. So sometimes there's a survival. Sometimes the industry does get taken over. What many people don't know is that there was a nascent startup television industry in the 1930s and late 1920s that was pretty primitive, but they were getting their start, and you could have seen television rise as a challenger to radio. But radio was headed by this genius of industrial combat named David Sarnoff, who had founded NBC, and he effectively basically suppressed the inventors of television. And when television was born in America, it came as a replica of radio. I mean, most people don't think, oh, wait, why did NBC so easily just become a television network? It wasn't easy. There was a very careful takeover of the television industry as a child, basically. And so it kind of goes one way or the other. And it was a long time until the only time television really turned into this, well, let's see what television can be and lots of wild ideas and strange things, was when cable started in the 70s. A lot of stuff started in the 70s, actually. That's one thing I'll tell you about this book. Yeah.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next to Inayat in Fort Worth. Hi, Inayat.
Yes, this is Inayat Galani from Fort Worth.
Mm-hmm.
And I have a question for your guest concerning the suppression of shortwave radio in the United States. Shortwave radio has a much wider reach, and for a large country, geographically large country like United States, shortwave made a whole lot more sense than a medium wave like AM and FM. But I understand that in the early days, there was a conscious decision by FCC to suppress shortwave so as not to allow the airwaves to be open to the communists and fascists and Nazi propaganda. Now, that's not freedom of speech, in my opinion, because we... all over the world, have Voice of America and other programs in the free Europe on shortwave bands. But we don't want other people's viewpoints to be heard by the American public. Is that an example of American exceptionalism, or what is it?
It's a great question, is what it is. There's a lot that radio is, and we're on the radio, so good chance to talk about it. Radio, the decisions made surrounding radio in the 20s and 30s are, to me, unendingly interesting. And there's this sense that the FCC in the 20s and the early 30s sets stuff up with assumptions that we now find highly dubious. They were supported by the Radio Trust very strongly, the AM networks, but all their assumptions were that fewer stations were better than more, that national is better than local, generally speaking, with some exceptions, and that domestic is always better than foreign. And so there's all these assumptions that went into radio, and they're still very much with us. Public radio in America basically disappeared from mid-30s until the late 60s when NPR got started again. Or actually was born, and it's a, there was a little bit of exceptions to that, there's some public radio, but very suppressed. So, yeah, there's a lot of assumptions that went into radio that are very different than what we think today, and the caller is right to bring them up.
But it's funny when you say public radio, because what exists today is very much a networked structure. There's independent stations all around, but most are tied into a larger network.
Networks are very powerful.
Mm-hmm.
It's a lot more... efficient, just to put it straightforwardly, to make one station and distribute it to millions of people. If we're talking about public radio, a show like Morning Edition or All Things Considered, or maybe I should name a PRI show, Marketplace, the fact they make one show from basically most of the country in radio is efficient. And that's always been the case, and that's one of the reasons these markets tend towards monopoly. But I'm saying there also needs to be room for localism, too. I mean, this is a local, relatively local show, regional show. Mm-hmm. And it's extremely important to keep that counterbalance always there, even though networks are incredibly powerful and efficient.
I want to talk about one of the things that really concerns you is the growing move toward a greater amount of vertical integration, particularly in the internet industry. This is essentially the idea that, and we don't want to pick on one in particular, but that Apple will sell you the music and they'll sell you the device to play it on, and then they have a partnership with the company that sells you access to the internet in the first place.
Yeah, that vertical integration is something I really talk about a lot. It's a complex topic, but it has a huge influence on the way our society is. And traditionally, going back to the 30s, the main idea of the Hollywood studios was that they would own everything. They would own the theaters, they would own the distribution, they would own production, the actors, the directors, NBC was relatively similar. They tried to put everything together. And AT&T, similarly, they owned the telephones. I'm on an old AT&T telephone right here. They owned the long distance. They owned everything. And that kind of vertical integration is again, has its efficiencies, but is particularly risky for speech. And the reason is because once you own the pipe and you're also the person who owns information, you always have an interest in discriminating in favor of your own stuff.
Yeah.
And I think this is the problem with the Internet. We have to really look out for this on the Internet. Is once, say, Comcast owns NBC, which is ongoing, or Apple has the exclusive partnership with AT&T or owns its own, has a special deal with Hollywood, they're always going to do stuff to make their content be the content you hear and look at. And I think that how free we are, how much diverse speech there is, really depends on how much joint ownership there is between the pipes and the content. It's a fundamental point.
So do you think the FCC is properly positioned to keep an eye on this?
They have the power. They don't have the will.
Mm-hmm.
That's the problem. Is the FCC, they're much more hesitant. In some ways, that's good because they don't create monopolies the way they used to. But I think they should really have an eye on stuff like the Comcast-NBC merger. And they should be prepared to stop certain mergers in the public interest.
1-800-933-5372 is our number. We'll go next on the phones to Bill in Dallas. Hi, Bill.
Hello. I just tuned you guys in. I don't know if you've already covered this, but back in the 90s, I discovered something called free software, and it was accompanied by something called the GPL, the GNU Public License, or otherwise copylefted and things like that. And I just wondered if your guest had any thoughts about that, whether it's just a gimmick or a really like a significant legal sort of contract, and if
right.
You had anything to say about it.
Sure. I don't want to get into the details of the – I am a copyright professor, but I don't want to get into the details. It's not central to the idea of the book, the enforceability of the GPL. It's a great topic. It's just not – but what is important, I think, that you're talking about is the free software movement. In America, through all these information industries, there are always these long-running battles, essentially between amateurs and big concerns. Early radio was started, early broadcast in the 1910s, by amateurs with the equivalent of ham radio stations. They're the ones who invented broadcasting, actually, and invented the idea of public radio. And there's always these kind of, I guess, individual counter-movements against power. And free software is a great example of that. I mean, it's not organized by any, there are people, but it's really a movement to resist too much power in software. And these movements, I think they're really important. I think they're very consistent with the American spirit, that when there's too much power in any one place, American people, and people around the world, but in this country in particular, tend to resist. And I think that's an extremely important tendency. And free software, I mean, is the geek version and something you can do from your basement, but I think is a really important historical phenomenon.
So do you imagine breakups on the horizon for any of these enormous companies that have formed seemingly overnight, you know, over the past decade, the Googles of the world?
I wouldn't say now, but I would not be surprised over the next 10 years or something. Right now, we're in this early kind of golden age. But if a company like Google or Apple or Facebook manages to stick around for 10 years or so, inevitably almost, despite their best efforts, particularly a company like Facebook, I can imagine they're going to start doing stuff that seems dubious.
Hmm.
How the government deals with that is a really tricky question. But what I learned from the book, if you want to have an effect on an industry, the most clear thing to do is you blow it up. You know, trying to sort of make a deal with them doesn't seem to work very well. And you kind of divide it into two pieces. And I think that is something we should not be afraid to do when the time comes. I'm not saying it right now, but I'm saying that must always be there as the ultimate remedy. Once a company is big enough and particularly well-connected to government enough, it becomes impossible for the market to displace it. AT&T, by the 70s, there was no company that was going to displace AT&T. They were too well-insulated. So the only answer was to blow them into pieces, and it had this enormously, I mean, there was some chaos, and phone service was chaotic, but you had an enormous entrepreneurial activity surrounding which eventually became the Internet. So it's very important that we keep that power in reserve when the time comes.
So it would make sense that if you were to break up a Google somewhere down the line, you might separate off the email portion from the news portion from the search engine portion. I'm wondering, though, about a company like Facebook, where you can't really break up the part of it that really draws people right now. And I know they're getting into email, but the part that people spend all their time with, you're there because, as you mentioned earlier, you want to see the most people in this small space that is Facebook.
Right. Well, what you do if in that kind of situation is you force the company to be interconnectable.
Mm-hmm.
So you make it so anyone can build an application that then accesses the database of friends, if you see what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So you might I might have a company called MySpace or something. I don't know. MySpace exists, where you have a standardized protocol for connecting with friends, and then you can see everyone through that interface. So what you do is you make the interface separate from the friend network. I know it sounds kind of abstract, but that's the way you do it.
No, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah.
What about this idea that all of these internet companies have a vested interest in not absolutely ticking off the people who use them right now? And to do that, they need to be somewhat trustworthy.
Well, that's important. That's always a constraint on firm behavior is consumers. And I got to say, the open internet is a really important constraint. That is to say, the idea that anyone, at least for now, can still build a company to threaten Google or Facebook is really important. I don't know, it's getting harder, but as long as it remains possible to challenge existing firms, that is a constraint. As for consumers, I think it's an important constraint. Once a company's been in charge and power for long enough, though, I mean, it doesn't act as much. Have you tried getting, let's say you're angry at your cable company. I mean, you can be angry all you want, but what can you do about it? They raise your prices. What are you going to you can completely cut the cord, but other than that, you're kind of out of luck. And it's hard to cut the cord if you want internet access. So once they've kind of got you, it's really established monopoly, it's hard for consumer pressure to have that much effect once they really know they've got you.
Is there anything we can do to make companies care about being honest and fair and honorable?
Well, one thing is there to always make sure there is a channel. Okay, I think there's two things. First of all, I think it's important that there always be a channel and some threat of going to a competitor somehow. Like, that's really important. The other thing is, I do think public shaming has some effect. I do think some of the people who run these companies have a sense that they want to be good people. And when the public is really tries to shame them, I think Google's a good example. Google sees itself as good. And when it gets shamed by the public, I think that has an influence on it. And the journalists also have an important role here. But no, the public, I think they're like public officials. They don't like angry people saying you are disgraceful. They find it embarrassing, and I think that has a big effect.
Of course, we still use Google to find places where people are talking about this sort of thing.
Yeah, that's true. But Google hasn't done that much bad stuff. Some of the listeners may disagree, but I think generally they've tried to do good. They've had a few areas where you can ask questions.
I'm afraid we're going to have to leave it there. We've run out of time. Tim Wu's new book is called The Master Switch, The Rise and Fall of Information Empires. Tim, it's been a really interesting hour. Thank you so much for spending it with us.
Oh, it's been great. I've loved it.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.
Think production team includes associate producer Betsy Lewis and engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.